Accession number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Reel 8. Now, you've got some more stories to give us an idea of what life was like on the Bednall.
Yeah. Well, are we ready to go? Well, shall we say domestic life on the Venerable was very interesting to me because I got quite friendly with, when I became a petty officer, I got quite friendly with the president of the mess, who was an airframes petty officer who had been in a long time pre-war, and during the time when the Japs attacked Trincomalee, he was on HMS Hermes. And when it's an experience that he never lost, because in April 42, the Japs attacked Trincomalee Airfield, and the Hermes had put to sea from Trincomalee in order to escape being attacked by the Japs. But it only got about 10 miles out of harbour before Japanese aircraft caught up with it and sunk it. And Larby, Petty Officer Larby, as he was, he was obviously in the water, and he managed to save himself, but a large number of his messmates got drowned. And he says he was always suffering nightmares from visions of these people getting drowned all around him. But he managed to get rescued and eventually got transferred to other aircraft carriers. I don't know which ones, but when I got to know him, he was on the Venerable and president of the mess. And I was quite pally with him, and he used to tell me a lot about life on the Hermes. And
but you were going to tell us about the mess.
Yeah, well, the mess was, because it was the air staff and the squadron personnel used to go on and off the ship when we arrived at ports and near to airfields. We got the worst messes, as you can well imagine. The ship staff, the permanent people on board, used to have the best messes. You can't blame them, really. But our mess was right up in the bows. And, of course, when the weather was bad, the motion was considerably up and down and sideways. There were about 40 of us in the mess. It was about, I suppose, about twice the size of this room. And they used to have hammock spaces there, but there weren't enough hammock spaces for 40 people. So some of us used to sleep on the floor in our hammocks. We used to spread our hammocks on the floor and sleep down there. But I slept on the anchor deck, the forward anchor deck, which was immediately above our mess, which was also, because obviously other people didn't want it, was a very noisy mess. When the anchor used to go out or get weighed, there was a hell of a row, because the anchor trunks used to go through our mess and down to the cable hole beneath us. So it was a very noisy mess, particularly when leaving harbour, getting ready to leave harbour, or getting ready to lower anchor when coming down. So it was a very crowded mess. And after I'd been there for a little while, the mess caterer resigned. I think I'd been in there about a month. And I wasn't very well accepted at the time, because I was amongst a lot of these older people. They'd done a lot of service, and who's this new bloke coming in, sort of thing. Well, Larby said to me one day, "Would you like to be mess caterer?" So I said, "What's it mean?" He said, "Making sure we've got all the mess gear we need. You've got to get fresh mess gear if any gets lost, we lose any kettles or anything like that." He said, when we get to Hong Kong, we'll get Chinese messmen. He says, you'll have to take charge of them. So anyway, I became mess caterer. And somehow that seemed to improve my standing in the mess. Because I think I can say I did a reasonably good job. Because like the other bloke, he let things go. In the pantry, as it was called, he'd let the cockroach population build up quite a bit. So the very first thing I did when I went in there, I made the messmen, who were ship's people until we got to Hong Kong, I made them clear out all the cockroaches and chuck them over the side. And gradually clean the mess up, because this bloke had let things go, you see, but my predecessor. So when we got to Hong Kong, we got three Chinese messmen, and I had to see that they got ashore quite regularly. There were two on shore, and one had to stay on duty for people who were on duty over during that time. So, and also making sure that everybody got their meals on time. Tried to persuade people who'd slung their hammocks over the mess tables to get out and so everybody else could have breakfast, which did increase my popularity sometimes, but it went on like that. And that was my job, in addition to being on the air staff, on the squadron.
What were your duties like with the Fireflies? Do you remember much about the sort of duties you did?
Yeah.
Or was it just the same? It's just you were attached to the squadron?
Much the same thing. Just servicing the aircraft, making sure they were ready for flight, signing the DIs, or making sure that people who'd done the DIs, like leading hands beneath us, had done the DIs and make sure they were all signed up for, making sure that we'd done the weekly inspections and signed for those, making sure the aircraft were fit for flight. If we weren't sure, we'd declare the aircraft US, unserviceable, but that wasn't a very very popular thing for us to do, actually. We used to get heavy pressure put on us to make things serviceable as soon as possible.
So what's the next that you recall from the Venerable?
Well, the Venerable, shall I venture on the venereal disease problem?
Yeah, what was the problem?
Very much. Because shortly after I joined the Venerable, they showed us an American film in which in graphic detail was described the various things that could happen to you if you got venereal disease. And they left very little to the imagination. They fired my imagination so much that I never got anywhere near that situation at all. But I'm afraid with a large number of people, both in our mess and the ship staff, they took no notice. With the result that we had quite a heavy venereal disease population on board. In fact, our ship got rechristened HMS Venereal.
What rate? I mean, was it
50, 20%? Oh, no, not as heavy as that. But I knew several people who had to leave, because what they had, they still thought venereal disease was contagious at that time. So what they did, if you went to the doctor and you got diagnosed with venereal disease, you were sent to a separate mess for people of your ilk, as I might say. This was given the name of Rose Cottage. And it was known as the Dirty Bastards Mess, amongst the rest of us. And they would stay there, but if they thought it was contagious, why did they let these people mix with us and carry on their daily duties? A mystery I've never worked out. And the ship staff rather looked down on us because they thought we were passengers, you see, didn't do a job of work. Air crew people and air staff, they were always joining the ship and going off. So they rather looked down on us. But it was manifested to me one day when a stoker, and I don't know how he got it, one of the off-duty stokers walked through the hangar when we were working on an aircraft. He had a bus conductor's uniform on. I was saying, any more fares, please? So I thought, it got so bad that not long after I joined the ship, I think the captain lost control. And he was replaced with another captain, Captain Story, who was a very good man, but a very strict disciplinarian. And one of the first things he did was to assemble everybody as a general muster on the flight deck and address the whole ship's company. He said, you must regard the air staff and the air crew as much a part of the ship's company as you are. He said, if you start any more of this nonsense about looking down on them or taking the mickey, I'm going to come down heavy on you. And after that, it died away. That was one thing that happened.
Anything else? What other stories you got?
Oh, yes. Well, I did realise that a lot of people like Larby, as a result of their wartime experiences, completely lost faith in God. They said, God can't exist, they said, because if he did, he wouldn't allow such terrible things to happen. Because Larby used to get drunk when he used to recall what had happened to him during the wartime. And he used to wake up sometimes at night with terrible nightmares. And a very good bloke, but he said, I don't believe in God anymore. He said he can't exist because if he did, he wouldn't allow these things to happen. And I found several others on board, amongst other parts of the ship's company, who had the same experience. And you couldn't argue with them, because who can prove God exists anyway? You've got to believe it or you don't. So I just used to let it go and just listen to them. And some of them would tell me very bad things that had happened during the war, both what they'd done and they regretted since. Like one bloke told me he'd was on a destroyer during the war, and he'd they'd rammed a German submarine, and all the crew of the submarine jumped off and started swimming towards the destroyer. He said, of course, you hear all these tales about how wonderful we are, how we'd rescue these poor sailors in the water, take them on board ship and look after them. He said, well, we didn't. We machine gunned them. And I believe he was telling me the truth. Because as he said it, he started crying.
Now, what? So, how long were you out there for?
What, in Hong Kong? Well, by the time, by the end of February 47, I think they realised that things were settling down, that there was no longer a requirement for the British Pacific Fleet. All the wartime upheaval and the post-war upheaval was now over. And that they were going to reduce the naval presence out in that area. So the Venerable, and I believe the Vengeance, came home, leaving the Thesis and the Glory out there.
Now, what do you remember of the trip home?
Well, it was a very leisurely one. We did no flying. We used to attend lectures by various members of the ship staff on damage control, all that sort of thing. There was one very nice chief petty officer who was who is in charge of the damage control team on board the Venerable, and he used to take us around and explain what we had to do if the ship got damaged, and what sort of things we'd have to do if bulkheads got damaged or we got torpedoed or anything like that. Of course, the time for that was long by. And explained to us the various types of things we'd have to do. He said, if you're ordered to shut down a hatch, he said, to keep the ship's water tightness going, he said, and you know there are people down there, you've still got to shut the hatch and let them drown, he said, because the safety of the ship is more important than the lives of a few people. And that struck me as a very hard thing at the time. But I can realise now that it's highly important.
Now, which way? Anything about the voyage, or was it just straight back?
Well, we came back. Our first port of call from Hong Kong was Singapore, and there we got a large number of aircraft put on deck. They were given to us by the Americans. They were Avengers. The Americans realised they didn't want them anymore. They didn't want the trouble of shipping them all the way back to the States. So they said to the British Navy, you can have these Avengers. So, not wishing to cause any offence, I believe, we said, thank you very much. Loaded all these Avengers on board, on deck. And then when we left Singapore, we were going through the Straits of Penang, we shoved them over the side. And somewhere here, I've got a picture of our ship proceeding through the Straits on its way to Colombo, where we had an export of coal. And there's various Avengers in stages of submergence. There's one right at the back. You just see its tail sticking out of the water. I'm surprised how they floated so well, because they were quite heavy things. But air was trapped inside them, of course. As the air was released, they used to sink. And one about a mile back, there was one with just its tail disappearing, another one with, say, half the fuselage, and our latest victim, we just pushed over the side, was just floating more or less as it was, but gradually going to sink. So we got rid of all the Avengers. We didn't tell the Americans what we'd done. And we came back past the Horn of Africa, Socotra, all that area, called an Aden, and just went and had a bit of shore leave in Aden for a couple of days. Then went on to Port Said and had some more shore time there, you know, about 1 or 2 days again. Called at Malta, where we met the HMS Ocean, which was going out to the BPF as a relief ship, letting one of the other ships come home. So we had a good trip around Malta, and it was, of course, at that time very severely bomb damaged. And I was impressed by the way the Maltese had stuck, because the bomb damage was worse than it was in London. I've seen quite a bit of that. But the bomb damage was quite heavy in Malta. And there again, we weren't there very long. And the next port was in Gibraltar, where a couple of my friends disgraced themselves at the governor's house. Finally, we got back to Devonport, and there, another friend of mine on board the ship, a Chief Petty Officer Nicklin, as he was, perhaps I shouldn't mention his surname, because I first got to know him when I joined the ship. He looked like Captain Kettle. He was a very imposing figure, very great long beard, tall man, it seemed, about 6 foot high. Very imposing, but when I got to know him, I thought at first I was greatly in awe of him when we first joined, But after I got the name, I found he was as soft as what, you know. And he's a very nice bloke, really. And one of the other people I got to know in the mess after September, he said, "Oh yeah, I know Nick Lynn," he said, because when we were out in the Western Desert together, I said, "The Western Desert?" He said, "Yes, we had a few Fleet Arrow aircraft out there helping the RAF." He said, "At the time of the 8th Army." I said, "Oh, I knew Nick Lynn." He said, "Nice bloke," he said, "but too bloody tight as a screwdriver." So he said, what they did, they promoted him, made him squadron chief, and put him in charge of all the paperwork. So he said, and that's his job now. So anyway, I got quite pally with Nick Lynn, and used to go ashore with him. I went ashore with him at Port Said once, and again at Gibraltar. But when we got to Devonport...
He was a chief petty officer.
He used to live quite apart from us, in another mess. And he went ashore, because he got native leave when he got to Devonport. And we weren't allowed ashore because it was only native leave, because our next port of call was to go up to Glasgow and get rid of the aircraft at, I believe it's Macrahanish. We had to disembark all the aircraft, return to Devonport, and then we'd all get sent off the ship. And eventually, as I say, I wound up at Leon Solent again. But anyway,
was the ship paid off then?
No, it hadn't paid off by that time. But when we got to Devonport the first time, Nick Lynn, being a native of Devonport, got shore leave. Native leave, as it was called. Any more?
No, I'm just wondering what happened.
Oh,
you've
well.
You said that twice. So
well, Nick Lynn had native leave. So I saw him go off with his very fierce beard and all the rest of it. And... next morning, after they all came back on board, I saw this figure who sort of was trying to avoid my eye all the time, clean shaven by now. And it didn't look quite like Nick. I didn't really recognise him. So I said, "Is that you, Nick?" And he said, rather, he said, "Yeah." I said, "Where's your beard?" He said, "I had to shave it off." I said, "What happened?" He said, "Oh, when I got home, I hadn't been home for 3 years," he said. "When I got home, the missus took one look at me, and she said, 'No conjugals until you've shaved that bloody beard off.'" It was rather more earthly put than that. But anyway, that's what happened to Nick. Because it was an offence to shave off a beard without requesting permission, he had to go up to the captain's table to answer a charge of shaving without permission. But when he told the captain this story, he told captain's story of this story about him and his missus, and I think the captain was amused. He said, "I'm going to let you off this time," he said, "but I'm going to put on a record. Next time you do anything like this, you get double." But the situation was, as I expect you know, that if you were clean shaven and you wanted to join the bearded ones, you had to request permission from the captain. And then after a month, if you were granted permission, after a month you had to go up to the captain's table and he'd see if your beard was in good enough state to be recognised, in which case you had to be re-photographed, and your old photograph had to be destroyed, and your new photograph put in its place. Well, instead of Nick Lynn doing this, permission to shave before he left the ship, he didn't shave off until he thought the missus would admire his wonderful beard, but she didn't. And that was the result. He got back, he said, "Well, what can I do?" he said. I said, "I had to have my conjugals." So he went to the captain's table, and the captain, as I say, was amused by this story. But that was the end of that.
Now, why did you leave the ship if it wasn't paid off? Because you hadn't been with
After this episode, after the native leave episode, we went round up to Glasgow, had to unload the aircraft, then returned to Devonport. The ship was paid off at Devonport, and everybody left the ship.
So when would that be?
Let me think. Early April 1947.
Now, where did you go?
After foreign service leave, I went to Leon Solent for a short time.
What were you doing there?
Again, odd jobs, until I got sent to RNS Lossiemouth.
Now, what happened there?
Well, again, when I got there, I had to go through the same old routine again, get introduced to the lieutenant who was electrical engineering officer, and I got put into a hangar where they had several hangars there. It had been an old RAF station, but the Navy had taken it over, and by that time they were doing quite a lot of naval flying from Lossiemouth. And
there wasn't a squadron there, though.
Not as such. It was a training place, really.
You were on the base staff then?
On the base staff, yes. But when I got there,
that would be when? When would you get there?
Mid late May 1947. And they only sent me there because I'd been conned into signing on for extended service while I was coming back from Hong Kong.
Now, tell me about that. How had you been conned into that?
Well, Lieutenant Pegler said to me, "Why don't you make the Navy a career?" I said, "Well, I don't know about that." I said, "But I'm not married. I haven't got a shore job. I've got no particular ambitions to go back into the seat just yet." So he said, "Well, why don't you take on extended service?" I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "It's either for 3 or 4 years. You could either have a 3-year option, or you can sign up for 4 years." He said, if you take that option, you get £25 as a bounty, and when you finish your time, you'll get £75 if you do 3 years, and £100 if you do 4 years. I thought, that's good, because £25 was a lot of money then. So I thought, well, I might as well do that, you know, save me all the hassle of going back, getting demobbed, and getting a shore job, and looking for a shore job. So I said, well, I'll do that.
Now, would you become a regular then?
Yeah. So he said, you become a regular. He said, but if you decide during your time on extended service that you want to go on and make it a career full time, do 12 years, then go on for pension, 22 years, he said, if you do that, if you don't pay back the £75, your 3 years won't count towards your full-time, your long service, you say. But if you pay back the £75, the 3 years you will do will count for your long service. So I said, well, that seems quite a good idea. I took the £25, which was paid to me on the ship, and signed up for 3 years extended service.
To 1950.
Now, yeah.
So what was happening at Lossiemouth then? You were obviously now, you've got 3 more years to do.
That's right.
So what was happening?
Well, I went up to Lossiemouth, and got introduced into the repair system up there for aircraft.
Which aircraft?
They had, again, Fireflies, and sea fires, and they were the main, they were the staple aircraft of the Fleet Air Arm at that time.
So they're just the usual routine duties.
Just,
of an electrical
Just doing instead of doing it on board ship, I do it on shore. And I got put in a hangar, and after a short space of time, somebody said to me, we want you to take charge of all the electricians in the hangar. So they were all mainly people, agent service group people, who had come in either just at the end of the war, just afterwards. They'd had their training, and all they wanted to do was to get out. They didn't want to, they didn't want any part of the naval life at all. They wanted to get out, you know. So I had to somehow jolly these blokes along to perform their duties in this hangar, working on an aircraft.